Blog Talk Radio.
And no matter where you've been or where you might currently find yourself, it's not over. When God is in it, there is no limit. New Breed.
It's not over. It's not finished. It's not ending.
It's only the beginning.
It's only the beginning. And God is in there.
All things are new.
All things are new.
My neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retrieview Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retrieview Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, a dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie, and either jeans or sweatpants and white tennis shoes. He's here now. He was just staring.
Oh, he's just walking around the area?
Looking at all the houses.
Okay.
Now he's just staring at me.
Okay, he said it's 1111 Retrieve You or 111?
That's the clubhouse.
That's the clubhouse. Do you know what the... He's near the clubhouse right now?
Yeah, now he's coming towards me.
Okay.
He's got his hand in his waistband. And he's a black male.
Okay. How old would you say he looks?
He's got a button on his shirt. Late teens.
Late teens, okay.
Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with him. Yeah. He's coming to check me out. He's got something in his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
Over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. These assholes, they always get away. Yeah. When you come to the clubhouse, you come straight in and make a left. Actually, you would go past the clubhouse.
Okay, it says on the left-hand side from the clubhouse?
No, you go in straight through the entrance, and then you make a left. You go straight in, don't turn and make a left. Shit, he's running.
He's running? Which way is he running?
Down towards the other entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay, which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
All right, sir, what is your name?
George. He ran.
All right, George, what's your last name?
Zimmerman.
And George, what's the phone number you're calling from? All right, George, we do have him on the way. Do you want to meet with the officer when they get out there?
Yeah.
All right, where are you going to meet with them at?
If they come in through the gate, tell them to go straight past the clubhouse. And straight past the clubhouse and make a left. And then they go past the mailboxes. You'll see my truck.
Okay, what address are you parked in front of?
I don't know. It's a cut through, so I don't know the address.
Okay, do you live in the area?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what's your apartment number?
It's a home. Oh, crap, I don't want to give it out loud. I don't know where this kid is.
Okay, do you want to just be with him right near the mailboxes, then?
Yeah, that's fine.
All right, George, I'll let him know to meet you with the out there.
Actually,
okay?
could you have him call me and I'll tell him where I'm at?
Okay, yeah, that's no problem.
You need my number or you got it?
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, no problem. I'll let him know to call you when they're in the area.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. That was the voice of George Zimmerman on the night of February 26, 2012, as he was reporting Trayvon Martin as a suspicious black male to the Sanford Police Department just minutes before he shot and killed him. Tonight's topic is, who is the real George Zimmerman? What we know about George is he was born George Michael Zimmerman. His race is white and Peruvian. His age was 28 at the time of the shooting. His religion, he had a Catholic upbringing. His marital status, he's married to Shelley Zimmerman. His parents are Robert and Gladys. He has two siblings. And his education, he was attending Seminole State College for Criminal Justice at the time of the shooting and was on academic probation. His father is a retired military man that worked as a magistrate judge. And his mother, Gladys, was a court clerk. These are some of the established facts. Now we want to explore, who is George Zimmerman, the person? He has been described as everything from an altar boy to a bully, a vigilante, a racist, and a wannabe cop. His attorney even asked the court to prohibit any of the negative terms about George Zimmerman from the court proceedings. But is that because he is trying to not let us know that that is the real George Zimmerman? Therefore, the proceedings will basically, when they use those terms, show George in the true light that a lot of the country believe that he is. Right now, he's one of the most hated people in the country. So tonight, we're going to be talking about who is the real George Zimmerman. But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. With that out of the way, y'all, we have some panel members that are not on the phone lines yet. So we're waiting to see where some of them are. I'm not sure. If you are one of my panel members, the boards are full. If you would press the 1, and that would allow me to know that you are one of the panel members that are supposed to be on the phone line tonight. But I do see 2 of the numbers that I recognize. The others I don't. And, again, if you are a panel member, please press 1, and that will allow me to know that you are supposed to be on the panel tonight. On the phone lines right now, I see Mr. A.J. Houston, and I also see Mr. Travis Schaefer. Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good.
I'm very good.
Y'all heard the intro. Who is the real George Zimmerman? Who is the real George Zimmerman? We'll start with you, Mr. Schaefer. Who's the real George Zimmerman? Who do you believe he is?
Well, I'm not really sure who he is, but I believe he has many faces, which you've discussed a few of them. And through his actions, he's brought forth a few of those faces.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. A.J. Houston, who's the real George Zimmerman?
Well, from what I've heard and what I know of what's gone on so far, he's a guy that wanted to be a policeman that nobody wanted in the neighborhood watch, and even the neighborhood watch members were complaining about him. So I think he was actually a racist. From everybody he called the police on was black and walking.
Right. Well, one thing that came to my mind today as I was going over my notes for the show, George Zimmerman was on the medication or prescribed the medications temazepam and Adderall. That said, those drugs are typically given to people who have been diagnosed as ADHD, which, is that the elephant in the room that nobody is talking about? Did he have a personality disorder, and the fact that he was on those drugs possibly caused him to overreact to a situation which really wasn't a situation at all, seeing that Trayvon Martin hadn't actually committed a crime? So being on these drugs and possibly, and it has not been established that he's ADHD, but we do know these drugs are typically prescribed to people that are. And his behavior, and we'll talk about so many strange behaviors, it does kind of speak to ADHD. Could that be the elephant in the room? Does he have a personality disorder that maybe his attorneys don't want brought up in court? Mr. Schaefer.
Yes, I'm having a little technical difficulties here hearing you.
Okay. Let's start again. Is it possible that the elephant in the room is that George Zimmerman is ADHD? And so if that's the case, the medication that he was on caused him to overreact to a situation that really wasn't even a situation, seeing that Trayvon Martin was not committing a crime at the time that he confronted him.
I would say it's definitely possible. Anytime that you're dealing with any type of substance that alters the mindset, such as these medications, they have different influences on different people. So it's very possible that they played a part in his reactions, the way he was thinking, and his actions altogether on any given night.
AJ Houston, what do you think?
Well, I think that, so far we would diagnose anybody that wants to be not diagnosed with something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his problem, you know, because the other calls were exactly the same. He just didn't chase them. So I don't know if he was actually taking the same drugs at those particular times or not. But I think his disorder is a cultural disorder.
Ooh. Oh, okay. Well, you know, you keep speaking of the calls, so let's talk about the calls. I'm looking for my notes, but George Zimmerman had actually made a total of 46 calls to police. 46 is a lot of calls, y'all, from the time that he had started as the neighborhood watch. And you wonder, like, okay, what is he reporting, you know, 46 times, because it doesn't seem like it was that much crime going on in the neighborhood. And I understand it was everything from, in 2004, they said he called 46 times, reporting everything from open garages to suspicious people. Do you think that maybe he enjoyed interacting with police? Maybe that kind of, you know, calling them and reporting things and having them come out, you know, and he and him getting familiar with them and what they do. Do you think that was something that George enjoyed doing?
I believe so. I believe that by him doing those types of things, he felt maybe personal with the police department or part of the police department, because he's tried to, you know, be a police officer before. And a couple of things that stood out, because I've listened to quite a few of the calls, and a lot of times that when he was reporting these activities, the people were just standing there. And this last call that you just played, two things that kind of stood out was when he stated that they always get away with this. Well,
yeah.
It makes me think, because, you know, they're not doing anything but standing there. What's there to get away from, that type of things? But I do think that by him being part of the neighborhood watch, making these calls, that probably, I think he maybe have kind of been part of a personal level with the law enforcement indirectly.
Wow. And AJ, do you agree with that?
Yes, I agree with it. But I think that was his closest, since he didn't pass the police exam and he wasn't a policeman, that was the closest he could be to being a police. So he liked, to me, he liked the authority. He liked the authoritative place where I can call on anybody, because, you know, even with this situation with Trayvon, he said, from a distance in the dark and the rain, it looked like he's on something. He's up to no good. And he was sitting there with his hand in his waist. So he said that. So I'm saying, so everything, it didn't matter if you were standing there or if you walked, it was a problem, because black men always get away with it.
You know, I have to agree with that, too. I think another thing that I saw, and I'm looking for my notes on that, you know, I wondered, with somebody calling the police department 46 times, you know, they kind of get to know your voice and who you are. You know what I mean? And with the officers going out, probably on the majority of these calls, they probably got pretty familiar with who George Zimmerman was, too. So is it possible the reason that they didn't initially charge Zimmerman was because it was kind of like one of their own? You know, because if they believed at all the story that he told initially, it kind of looked like he was a hero. You know, he was saving the community from this bad guy who was about to do something terrible, and he was calling them to say, you know, to stop whatever was about to happen, and unfortunately somebody was killed. And I think that was the initial spin on it. So is it possible that they didn't want to charge him initially because they considered him one of their own? Either of you.
Well, I believe it's possible that Mr. Gresham was actually wanting to charge him. It was the police chief that didn't want to charge him. And if you notice just what you said, see, the police can't do something to you because they think you're about to do something.
Oh, that's right. Police respond to a crime. They don't respond before the crime is committed.
Yeah, because he looked like a criminal. They don't come, you know.
But if you notice, George had a way of always setting up the scene that the police had to come,
Because, you know, if you didn't come, George made it look like something bad's about to happen. You know, I can tell this guy, you know, by his behavior, the way he's acting, you know, you guys better get here. He's wearing all black, and that was the same description of the person that broke into the houses. And so, therefore, you know, I'm calling y'all because, I'm trying to do the right thing. So how can the police not respond when George Zimmerman is calling them and he knows the right things to say to get them out there?
But he also said he's on drugs in the rain.
If he what?
I said he also said he looked like he's on drugs in the rain from about 20 or 30 feet.
Okay, we lost that last. Can you repeat that last comment?
I said he also said he looked like he on drugs from about 20 or 30 feet in the dark in the rain. So that's a hard call to me.
Yeah, you know, and I agree with that totally. And I listened to the Hannity interview that he did, and I'm going to go to a caller in a minute. But I listened to the Hannity interview, and George Zimmerman clearly just told this dispatcher that Trayvon Martin was running. He got on Hannity's show and said, "Well, no, he wasn't running; he was skipping." Now, I don't know if anybody else heard what I just heard. I just heard running. He's running.
I heard
and
that he
told
was
Hannity,
running. And that,
I mean, go ahead.
I was going to say that I heard on the tape that he said that he was running, and then at one point he said he has ran. So that, meaning he's already gone from the scene.
Exactly. He got on Hannity and changed that and said, no, what I meant was not running, but skipping. And because Hannity was questioning him, you know, do you think he was in fear of you? Is that why he was running? And that's when he changed it and says, well, no, he wasn't running, he was skipping. I don't think he was afraid of me. Well, how can you establish all of that and you never talk to the person? Typically, people run because they're afraid. I don't know. But I just thought, you know, if we're talking about deciding whether or not we can believe George Zimmerman's story because Trayvon can't tell his, doesn't all of these switches, you know, about what happened that night, and I know anytime anybody makes a police statement, it's going to change a little bit because, you know, the mind is funny and you forget a little bit and, you know, you add a detail that you forgot to mention, you know, before. But there's a clear difference between skipping and running.
Well, I think with George Zimmerman, his details should be they should limit it in, as far as variation because he's called in numerous times and made detailed complaints. And his scenario of what happened should be consistent because of his mentality of wanting to become a police officer and being detailed. So the variation, it should be limited variations in his story.
True. And, you know, another thing that he changed his story on, he told the operator that he looks like he's in his late teens. He got on Hannity's show and said, I think he's closer. He was closer to my age. Or he later changed his statement and said, you know, I thought he was closer to my age. Well, you clearly told the – I'm sorry?
His initial statement to the 911 operator would have been more efficient since it was right then and there, not later as – He explained. So his mindset would have been in a clear motion as he's describing Trayvon Martin.
To the operator, months or a year later, I agree. So I thought that was very strange. Those to me are two very key things that he's changing and saying, well, you know, I meant to say, or no, I didn't say that, I said this. Well, to me, that has a lot to do with whether or not we can believe him and his side of the story. See, and Trayvon can't tell his. I'm just saying that is just something. Were you saying something, AJ?
Yeah, to answer the first part of your question before you added the second, does that mean that when the policeman said don't follow him, that George Zimmerman was skipping too because he sounded like he was moving pretty fast and the wind was blowing in the phone?
This is true. Well, he told the operator that he was following him, and he sounded like he was pretty winded. So, yeah, I agree. So, I don't know. It's just, you know,
so
to me.
I mean,
I'm sorry. I don't know what skipping looks like in the dark. I mean, because to me, moving looks like moving, you know. So
I'm not really sure many teenagers actually skip anymore. I mean, I've rarely heard that. I've rarely heard of any teenagers skipping. They're either jogging, running, or walking. I never heard of anybody really actually skipping anymore.
Well, that's what he told Hannity, which, of course, you know, didn't go over very well. I see Alberta Parrish has joined us. I'm going to open up her phone line. And then we're also going to go to area code 214-636. Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Yeah, I just got here. And I wanted to talk about Zimmerman's abusive behavior toward his ex-girlfriend. That's really what I want to talk about. You know, the media doesn't really talk about that much. You know, they don't explore that part of him. You know,
well,
but
we got that in,
sounds
in,
like
in,
he was an abusive guy.
They said that she took out a restraining order on him because he hit her, right? And then
yes.
He later took out a restraining order against her, said that she had hit him with a bat.
Oh, wow. And you know what? He probably deserved it.
Oh, wow. Oh,
because, you know, she was fighting back against this abusive guy, you know, so he probably deserved to get hit by a bat, a baseball bat.
Hey, I think you have some noise. Somebody's got some noise in their background. Albert, is that you?
No.
Okay. 36, your line is open. Welcome to Center Stage.
Hello?
Yes. Hi.
I was just listening. I don't know how it put me in queue.
Okay, when you press one, that opens or raises your hand.
No, I never did it even. No, it did it itself. I didn't open it up.
Okay, we'll close it. Thank you. Okay, well, that said, you know, the whole thing with the restraining orders and George Zimmerman with the girlfriend, you know, he took out a restraining order back against the girlfriend and said that she had hit him with a baseball bat. And so George Zimmerman, you know, it just kind of makes me wonder if he's got a temper. You know, I mean, nobody's wanting to admit it, but I'm just wondering if he has a temper and his family and friends are covering, you know, for Zimmerman and saying that he's a nice guy and, you know, they don't know him to do any of these bad things, but...
He may be bipolar.
Well, I'm just kind of wondering if he is biting off more than he can chew and then crying victim afterwards.
Ooh, very true, very true. I'm looking for those notes on that, y'all, because I really want to move to something that I found very fascinating from Witness 22 that's going to talk about George Zimmerman in the trial. But I'm trying to find what happened with the girlfriend because he was ordered. Excuse me. I'm going to have to come back to that later because I can't find it. But what I do know about, let's see. Okay, here we go. Zimmerman had run-ins with the law in 2005. He was arrested for shoving a police officer doing an underage drinking raid. Charges were dropped after Zimmerman completed an alcohol education program. And then Zimmerman, in the same summer, he and his fiance had whatever the situation was, and she took out the restraining order against him, alleging that he had hit her. And he responded by taking out a restraining order against her, claiming that she had hit him with a baseball bat. So that was in 2005. Then in the same year, Zimmerman reportedly lost his job working as security for illegal house parties for losing his temper. So I see a pattern. I don't know if anybody else. I see a pattern, you know, with
a pattern based on the crowd that he's with and who it's with.
Oh, okay.
You're kind of a heckle and jive with his family and friends is one way, and then when he's out, when no one's looking, so to speak, he's a different way.
That could be very true. Because, you know, they said, the coworker said that George Zimmerman's temper at work became a liability. So they eventually had to let him go because basically, I guess, these rages that he would fly into, they saw them as the situation not being as big as George would make them, so they had to let him go. So it seems like he's had some problems on the job, which takes me to Witness 22, y'all. And we're moving pretty quickly, y'all, tonight because we can only talk about George Zimmerman for the first hour. We're talking to Mr. A.J. Houston in the second hour about his new book, Making It. So I'm moving pretty quickly tonight, y'all. But Witness 22 is of Middle Eastern descent, and his account or statements to the police about George Zimmerman, to me, are very telling. And this is what Witness 22 said. Witness 22 said that when he worked with George Zimmerman. George was a crowd pleaser. And so George would basically heckle this guy and do all these comedic acts, you know, in the lunchroom about this guy. And this guy went on to say that George, you know, would say, you know, in a Middle Eastern, you know, accent, I'm a terrorist, you know, so, you know, which is a cruel, you know, thing to say to someone Middle Eastern. And he would say this, and this is this guy's job. And so George would do all of these things to the point that, you know, he would give the guy things to do that really didn't have anything to do with the guy's job description. And then when the guy would do it, George would then tell everybody, this guy's an idiot, he's a moron, you know, he's stupid, you know, he listened to me and I told him to do X, Y, Z, and that isn't even his job, that type of thing. So the guy said that his actions were that of something like a middle school or a high school pranks, but at the same time, they had a racial overtone to them. And he said that George did this to him to the point that he wanted to do some violent, you know, things to George. But eventually, George ended up getting fired from the job, and the guy didn't even have to do that because what happened was George made so many complaints to corporate about how the store was being run and how that he thought things should be better and da-da-da-da. And so he contacted them so many times that HR said, let him go. We got to let him go because, you know, he's more trouble than he's worse, so let's get rid of him. So does that kind of speak, too, to the fact that, you know, George Zimmerman's family keeps saying that he's not a racist, yet we keep seeing all these things that kind of indicate there's something to that racist, you know, term that people keep using when they say George Zimmerman?
Alberta. I think that's definitely an element.
Yeah. And that was you, Mr. Schaefer?
Yes, it was. Go ahead, Alberta.
I mean, I see a pattern. You know, mm-hmm. So that's why I brought up the domestic abuse allegations, because I do see a pattern with this guy becoming very angry, blowing up at people. And, you know, I just had, you know, recently ended a relationship myself with a guy that was quick to blow up at people. And I'm wondering whether this guy may have bipolar disorder. I'm wondering mm-hmm. whether Zimmerman has bipolar disorder because, you know, he might be on medication right now for something. On some type of medication for psychiatric problems, and that could have affected his judgment on the night that he shot Trayvon Martin.
I wonder if his medical records are going to come into play, because I think they're very important to this case, because that same coworker said that he ended up writing a letter to management and HR about the taunting that George kept putting him through. And he said that when they got their turn to go to the manager and discuss it, he said George was so convincing, he sat there thinking, well, did I overreact? George was, this guy says, his witness 22 makes this statement to police. He said George was so absolutely convincing that he himself began to wonder, well, maybe I did overreact. Okay? That gives, that to me, that was very telling, you know, that this guy knew that, you know, George, you know, basically he said George was a crowd pleaser. George would get in front of people and do this. You know, when they were one-on-one, it wasn't anything going on. But whenever George was in front of a crowd, then George was a crowd pleaser or tried to fit in, you know. So that was just, you know, I just found, you know, Witness 22 just absolutely fascinating when, as he described his situation of working with George over I think, a course of a couple months. But it was horrible for him. Also, another thing I found out about George is George's background from a kid could have a lot to do with how he turned out as well. They say he had a very strict upbringing. You know, he was a Catholic, and his father was very strict. And the neighbors in the neighborhood, the old Manassas neighborhood where they grew up, said that Robert Zimmerman never allowed his kids to play with the other neighborhood kids, that they played in the yard amongst the three of them, but they were never allowed to come out and play with the other kids. Does that speak to the fact that maybe he wasn't well socialized?
Well, I think it speaks to the fact that it shows that where he wants to play into the control and the authoritative position, being controlled and himself growing up.
Ooh. Ooh. Now that could be that. You know that could be. It could be an authority thing that he resented the way that his father. Is that what you're saying? Was so strict with
him?
Right.
I'm saying when you're raised that way, you kind of take on that persona and downbring it to your kids and so forth, and you live it out in your life form.
That could be very true. AJ, you agree with that?
Well, kind of sort of, but I think the underlying question is, how was George Zimmerman's father around other cultures? Because he could have garnered his attitude toward blacks from the little knickknacks and things his father said, so he didn't have any interaction with anybody else.
He could have been taught that.
That could be very true. You know, and the thing is, you know, I think, too, that George Zimmerman, I don't know if I really believe either he gets it or he's turned this whole thing into like a big, like, I'm a celebrity kind of thing, which doesn't make sense because, you know, in one of the hearings early on, during the bail hearing, George Zimmerman apologized to Trayvon Martin's family. He even asked for a private meeting with them. But body language experts say that George did not appear sincere and that it was an act for the cameras. And so does he, like... Does it what? I'm sorry. Who was at this phone?
Well, I heard a phone drop, too, so...
That was me. I'm sorry. I apologize. But I think... You know, it kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, maybe George thinks this is like a big, you know, thing for him to, like, become this rock star, you know, kind of mentality as opposed to the fact that this is a very serious situation in which a 28-year-old man took the life of a 17-year-old for absolutely nothing. You know, so I wonder if George Zimmerman even looks at it like that because I was looking on his Facebook page, and you know, this is what he said, and I just found this shocking because it's like he doesn't get the big picture. He said, on February 26th, I was involved in a life-altering event which led me to become the subject of intense media coverage. As a result of the incident and subsequent media coverage, I have been forced to leave my home, my school, my employer, my family, and ultimately my entire life. This website's sole purpose is to ensure my supporters they are receiving my full attention without intermediaries. Does that make sense? That's what I said. Does that make sense?
Wow.
Go to go to his Facebook page. That's on there. And
I was going to say, see, initially when it happened and they let him go, he had to think that he was scot-free.
Oh. This was posted April 1st, 2012.
I'm saying because he went down and they took the pictures and talked to him and kind of let him go because the arresting police officer wanted to arrest him and charge him with murder. It was the other officers within there that said, okay, they tried to defuse the situation because if it didn't receive this media attention, it would have been hush-hush and it would have been kind of swept under the rug until everything just went completely, array.
Wow. You could be right. Alberta, what do you think?
What do I think? I mean, you know, this guy, first of all, I hope he get life in prison, but, you know, that might not happen. I know it may not happen. I mean, I'm just saying it may not happen because he is only charged with second-degree murder, but if he was charged with a hate crime, he might get life in prison, you know, but they didn't charge him with that because they wanted to cover up the fact that this was a hate crime from the beginning. Okay, so... I got a problem with that. But, you know, I think that this guy, he profiled Trayvon Martin from the beginning, from the very beginning. And he went after this guy. He assaulted this guy. He assaulted Trayvon Martin, and he killed him. You know, it should be first-degree murder, but, hey, you know.
You know,
well,
speaking of that.
I believe the second-degree murder does carry a life sentence.
Oh, it does?
From what I've read.
Okay. State of Florida, okay. All right.
You know, it's funny
so.
You all are talking about.
Yeah, I didn't know that. You're educating me on something I did not know.
And I meant to
look
that up.
Yeah, I believe the second degree does carry that.
It does. I wish somebody,
if
y'all could Google that, for the end of the hour. Because, you know, what I found out, I was listening to HLN After Dark again today, one of their YouTube videos about this, and they were talking about the second-degree murder charge. And two attorneys said that if they had to choose between sitting on the defense or sitting as a defense attorney or sitting as a prosecuting attorney, they would prefer sitting on the defense side. And their explanation was that the defense issue, George Zimmerman, you know, is claiming it was self-defense, and all of these different questions that he brought up, you know, making it look like, you know, Trayvon Martin, you know, approached him and Trayvon Martin hit him and he was just defending himself. They said, you know, the burden of proof is going to be on the prosecution. So, therefore, they felt second-degree murder would actually be hard to prove and that he may get manslaughter.
Oh,
well, I believe by him actually having claiming self-defense, even though the state is required to prove it as well, I believe he has to maintain that proof because he has to defend himself for self-defense. And by claiming self-defense and defending it, he is, in essence, he has to prove that it was self-defense.
Hmm. You know, I looked, you know, at the file again today, and one thing I noticed, and if you look on the pictures on the website where they show the two pictures side by side of George Zimmerman's face the night that the shooting took place, and then the back of his head where they're showing, you know, the little cuts that he got and the little blood running down it, pay attention to his jacket. Front and back, the top part of his jacket on the back side has nothing. No grass stains, no mud, no nothing. The front of his jacket and his jeans and his shirt, no blood stains, no grass stains, no nothing. Isn't it almost impossible for George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin to have had the physical altercation that he claims to have happened and none of George Zimmerman's blood got on Trayvon Martin? Isn't that almost impossible? You know, this is a guy who's telling us to believe his side of the story, but isn't that almost impossible?
Well, that was some of my concerns that I've, upon reading this case and stuff, and, you know, there's just a lot. I see the mud and debris on Trayvon Martin's clothes in those photographs, but I don't see any on George, and George was supposed to have been one on his back in grass, so the dirt and debris would be more likely to be on him than Trayvon Martin. And
we
know
Trayvon Martin's body was found on the ground, so that's consistent with
the
stains
on
his
ground. George Zimmerman was.
No, I mean the way they found the body.
Right. But what I'm saying is if Trayvon was just merely laying there and that mud and debris is on him, on his clothes, George was supposedly moving in the grass and sliding up and down trying to get away from the sidewalk, it would be more visible on his clothes than Trayvon Martin's clothes.
And the police statements, y'all, they state is that George Zimmerman's back was wet, which was consistent with being on the ground, which actually is not true. It was raining that night. So a wet back is consistent with walking in the rain or running in the rain. That's not consistent with being on the ground in the rain. So, it's so many things. And, you know, Schaefer, you posted something on Facebook, and I forgot all the points that you made. Can you kind of go over some of the points that you saw as inconsistencies with this case?
Well, sure. A couple that I remember right off, because I don't have the paper here, but one is the issues in the photographs of the clothing. Like I said, you know, George Zimmerman's statements, he said he was scooting down away from the sidewalk, and then he would have been sliding in the dirt and grass, so those markings would have been visible on his clothes more than Trayvon Martin's clothes. And then the blood and DNA on Trayvon Martin's hands, there is none. George's nose was bleeding, and if they're at that close of a contact, and he said in his statements that Trayvon had his hands over his nose and his mouth, so the blood would have been there.
Very true.
That's how,
Shouldn't Trayvon Martin have had should have had George Zimmerman's DNA on it, his blood all over Trayvon's hands?
I think he would have, because he said he was smothering him and his hands over his nose. His nose was already broke at that point.
I so agree. And these are things, y'all, what we're speaking to tonight is if we are to believe the only witness that to the initial altercation, then we got to believe, we got to, first of all, believe everything he said. And if there's inconsistencies in what he said that may prove him to be a liar, that speaks to character, which speaks to what really, you know, can we believe what he said really happened that night? That's vital to this case, y'all. There's no way around it. We got to believe George Zimmerman. Things happen like he said it happened, or to me, that says something else is wrong with this story. And you know, the question that they kept talking about on HLN is the issue with reasonable doubt. And I thought, if this whole thing hinges on reasonable doubt, George Zimmerman has been around law enforcement long enough to know, and his father being a judge and mother being a court clerk, enough to be able to put reasonable doubt in the minds of the people that are going to be listening to this case, or even his initial statement.
I kind of disagree because, see, initially, the pursuit of anybody is an act of aggression. As a policeman told him initially, say, are you following him? And he's reading her and say, yeah. He say, well, we don't need you to do that. So that's the main thing right there. That's the main clause in this whole argument, is that to pursue somebody, even if he turned around and he ran, because he said Trayvon was looking at him, and then Trayvon understood that he was talking on the phone about him. But Trayvon turned and ran. So when you see somebody talking about you, being in pursuit of you, that's an act of aggression.
You know, another thing that speaks to honesty, you know, whether or not we believe George Zimmerman's side, is these screams. We've listened to those 911 tapes of those 14 screams in 38 seconds. That said, George Zimmerman could not consistently have made 14 screams in 38 seconds if his mouth was being smothered. And if you listen to those screams, none of those screams sound like they were broken up.
No, and I've also heard the reenactment of the screams that the police did with George Zimmerman, and they sound nothing alike.
No.
I think there would be some differences in it, because he wasn't under complete distress when he was reenacting it, but there should have been enough similarity in it, because it is his voice, supposedly. And another thing about as far as Carrick, I mean, he's already been proven to lie because of the issue with the bond here. And he lied in court, and that was not even with him being, his freedom being threatened as much as second degree murder would carry. So why would he would lie more in that case than the bond hearing?
You know, I totally agree. So, you know, all we're establishing, y'all, is the fact that if we're going to believe this whole, we're going to believe this whole story just the way George Zimmerman said it happened, then we got to believe him as a person who doesn't lie. And if all these things are lies, then George Zimmerman, that speaks to George Zimmerman's character. You know, another thing I have to question is, you know, he said he never racially profiled, you know, black men. He said he wasn't a racist. Yet, I don't know if anybody's gone to his Facebook page, I mean, MySpace page, but George Zimmerman had a MySpace page, y'all, and you're going to be very shocked when I tell you what his handle was. His handle, Lord, let me find that those notes on that. I was very shocked that George Zimmerman, I don't know who his friends are. It speaks to, you know, it speaks a lot about who is George Zimmerman's friends. I think you said something about that earlier, Schaefer. Who's he hanging with? His log on was that Niggy. That Niggy.
Oh, wow.
D-A-T-N-I-G-G-Y.
Wow.
That Niggy. Okay, and so I'm trying to figure out, if you're on MySpace, typically you got some friends on MySpace, so who are you hanging with that it's cool for you to have that log on?
I mean, not as a grown man. I know teenagers do it, but
wow.
No.
Well, you know what? I'm like this.
I didn't know that either.
listen, is there, y'all? And I'm thinking, who was he hanging with that was acceptable? Because, you know, I got white friends, y'all, and ain't none of us that close that they could use that log on and we be cool anymore. So was this something that George Zimmerman said amongst his white friends? Or, you know, where did that come from? That's just my question. You know, why did he have it? Where did it come from? And who were his friends that it was acceptable? Just a question. Just a question.
It's not acceptable. I'm saying it's not acceptable from jump. So he had to have some other people, maybe flying Confederates in their trucks. I'm not sure.
Very good.
It means exactly what it means. That nigga. That's what it comes across
as.
That's
what I'm saying. So it's not acceptable. So you definitely have to have some people that are saying the same thing as you.
Exactly. That feel the same way.
And I'm looking for my
notes. I know a lot of white supremacists visit my Facebook page and my YouTube page as well. A lot of them. And they leave negative, derogatory racial epithets on my channel. And, you know, I'm not surprised. Because I have a lot of them that watch my videos, you know. So, you know, YouTube is a front for white supremacy anyway, and that's my opinion, okay? But anyway, to me, YouTube is a front for white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I made videos about it. But, but it just means, like I said, that nigga, you know, he was a racist and always has been, you know. So whether he was taught how to be that, whether his parents were that way and they taught it to him, you know, it doesn't matter. He was a racist. You know,
okay,
so.
Let me correct that. His MySpace account name was Dat, D-A-T, Niggy, N-I-G-Y,
uh-huh.
T-B.
Uh-huh,
Dat,
I see it.
Dat Niggy T-B. And it that's supposed to be a mash on the term Dat Niggy and Tugboat. Okay, I don't know if that's
a
cartoon. I don't know. Is that a cartoon? You know, I don't have any kids, so I don't know. When I saw Tug, but
see,
I would
take it as that nigga. He means that nigga. See, to me, that's how it looks.
You got kids, AJ, and you hadn't heard of it.
I got kids, never heard of that. So.
Exactly.
Okay. When somebody says I'm not racist, to me, that typically indicates that I can look at your past and I won't find anything that looks like a racist. But when I look at George Zimmerman's past, it's not crystal clear that he's not a racist. You know, the fact that he said they always get away, the fact that he seems to racially profile black people that came through that subdivision, the fact that he's using a log on, you know, like that Niggy TB, I don't know. But that I found very, very interesting, y'all. And I just thought, okay, you know, somebody's going to have to prove to me that racist comment that people say about George Zimmerman just isn't true. But so far, I haven't found any evidence.
One other thing, since they were trying to bring Trayvon's pictures from his Facebook page and him, you know, all these other things in, so evidently George Zimmerman's items are coming into play also. But Trayvon is not accepted. But they brought that in the media just to try and, I guess, dispel anybody they have on the jury to thinking that he was this nice young man, which none of the pictures depict that he wasn't. But that was what they were trying to show, that he's, you know, he has a gun in the picture and he's smoking a doobie in the picture. So they're trying to show this as a part of gangbanging or a part of whatever. But they were just trying to, you know, I guess, inflame his name before the jury was picked.
And, you know, but the thing is, you know, people and those that support George Zimmerman, you know, they don't seem to get, you know, that, in my opinion, that Trayvon Martin is not on trial. You know, and secondly, you know, I saw someone who wrote the most ignorant comment on Facebook, and they said, it doesn't matter who pursued who or who the aggressor was. Once the fight began and someone's beating the crap out of you, you do what you can do to save your own life. And I thought,
well,
if the law
is
I have a theory behind that. I think that it was George Zimmerman that was on top of Trayvon Martin.
I agree.
And Trayvon Martin obviously was screaming for his life. He was screaming help. He screamed 14 times in 38 seconds. He was screaming for his life. While
you know what?
Zimmerman
I'll go on record as saying
on
something.
Top of him, probably with a gun in his face. And that's what
I, and
I'm
I agree.
At.
I you know what? I'll go on record.
About...
Go ahead, Schaefer.
I was going to say one of the theories that I've had about the gun is there was one point in George Zimmerman's statements where he said that when he hung up from the dispatch, he normally places his phone in his pants pocket, and this time he placed it in his jacket pocket, and then he said he went to reach for it in his pants. I think he intentionally did that to show Trayvon, hey, I have a gun. I mean, why else? You just got off the phone with dispatch. You know where you put the phone at.
You know what I thought, and I heard that same thing, Schaefer. What I think happened with that, I think you don't run into the dark unless you're holding your gun. You know, we know
exactly.
He has a wannabe cop mentality.
His didn't work.
I'm sorry? His flashlight didn't work.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He ran into the dark, and no one, his flashlight didn't work, and you're probably right that he probably had it holstered or out.
I mean, it just doesn't. It, to me, I mean, if I'm chasing this big bad person, you know, who I think is about to do something, and I'm chasing him into the dark at night, if I got a gun, the safest place for my gun to be is in my hand. So, the screams began almost immediately after Trayvon Martin hung up that or the phone disconnected from Trayvon Martin. So, if the truth be known,
exactly.
Is it possible? Huh?
Exactly, because
yeah.
He had attacked. Trayvon Martin, he pushed him, he shoved him.
And now, another
I'm
issue
thinking,
that I have is
I'm thinking that he shoved him to the ground.
Happened.
He was on top of Trayvon Martin. Trayvon was screaming for his life,
mm-hmm.
and he shot him while mm-hmm. Trayvon Martin was on the ground. That's what I'm thinking.
Right. Well, another thing that I'm curious about is, you know, right when that gunshot went off, the scream stopped. And if
yes.
George was in fear for his life, why would you not shoot again? Or why would you just immediately stop? Because he said he didn't know that he hit Trayvon. So
yeah,
if
you
know,
when George Zimmerman did the reenactment with the police, when he walked through the complex and was telling them what was going on, you know, from this point to that point, you know, he says, you know, he was on top of me and I saw somebody come out of right here, pointing at one of the apartments, and he said, and I said, help, help, help. You know, get me some help or something like that. Well, that's not consistent with him holding his hand over your mouth. You know, and you're at what point were you able to tell him that when he was holding his hand over your mouth and your nose and smothering you? Y'all, there are just so many inconsistencies. We could do this all night.
And no,
but listen, y'all,
Trayvon, I mean, well, George Zimmerman lied.
Yes.
That's really what it boils down to. He is a pathological liar. He lied.
And you know what, and I think that needs to go be established going into this trial, that if the truth be known, there have been enough inconsistencies in George Zimmerman's statement for people not, you know, to set his statement in stone and realize that this man is in the battle of his life, and that's for his freedom. And so he is saying whatever he can say to try to get himself off. And so I really don't believe much of his statement because it's inconsistent with the facts. You know, that's
exactly.
What I got to say about that tonight, y'all. But, yo, that's going to have to be the final word on our first half of this night of tonight's show. We're going to thank Alberta Parrish for being with us and also Mr. Travis Schaefer. AJ Houston is going to go into the second hour with us. Thank you guys so much for being on the panel tonight.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Good night.
Okay, good night. Okay, y'all, we're going to talk to Mr. A.J. Houston in the second hour. A.J. Houston has a brand-new book out titled Making It, and he's an established poet, a very good one, y'all. And so A.J. is going to tell us all about his new book, Making It. Well, A.J., good evening again. How are you?
Yeah, good evening, Carrie. How you doing?
I'm good. You know, we know you've been working on this book for a while, and it went into publication as of when?
The 4th of June.
The 4th of June.
So
this is your baby that you've birthed. Tell us, you know, what will somebody find when they read the book Making It?
Well, I call it Making It because, you know,
all the rappers, that's what they're talking about, but they have all the leased equipment, so you can see the Lamborghinis and the helicopters and the yachts.
Mm-hmm.
But see, most of the rappers that I like, the hustle was them trying to get the deal. Like Kanye, when he first came out, he was trying to get the deal. His mouth was wired shut, but you couldn't stop him from spitting. And T.I., when he was first on his hustle, he was hustling. It wasn't nothing gonna stop him. And making it is my idea of, you have to pay homage to everybody that helped you to get where you are.
Right.
So making it is you seeing your dream to fruition. It's not all the shiny trinkets and everything else that everybody else thinks comes from this persona of making it. It's the act of seeing your dream come to fruition.
Wow. So that's how you came up with the title, Making It.
Well, yeah, definitely.
Now, your craft is you know, and you're going to have to do a piece for us tonight. You're just going to have to do that. Y'all, listen, I can listen to AJ tell poetry or say poetry all night. I mean, he's just got it like that. So, you know, be thinking of which piece you're going to, you know, tell us or say for us tonight. But, you know, when you were doing this book, you know, your work, and I've listened to a lot of it. We've even done a show, y'all. If y'all go back in the archives, we've done a show with AJ before about his poetry, and he did some fabulous pieces on that. But when you're writing as a poet, are you writing out of pain? Or are you writing out of just life experiences? Or where does a poet draw from to come up with his pieces?
Well, I think different poets draw from different places, but I think the art, you know, that's what I was saying. When you talk about creative writing is the art of writing creatively.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not drawing from your pain or just experiences. Somebody else can tell you about them, and you can see how you can explain what they've been through in writing it. So you're writing their story for them because they can't tell it themselves.
You know, you've been writing poetry for how long?
I've actually been writing probably all my life. I think I was reading when I was 3, so I started writing poetry slightly after that because I love Dr. Seuss. You know, Dr. Seuss was my man.
He was a man. So how many pieces do you think you've done over a lifetime?
I don't know. I'm saying in 2011, I wrote a poem every day, so I wrote 365 poems in 2011.
Wow. Does somebody have to have a great vocabulary to be a great poet, or can it be as simple as you know, someone who has a fifth-grade education? Is just about the craft and the gift rather than the eloquent words?
Well, I think a poet can be all those things from the beginning, but I think the art of poetry is showing that you have the ability to grow.
Mm.
Just like if you planted a peach tree in the backyard and you saw the little buds on it, it looked like little pecans green.
Yeah.
And 5 years later, it still had the same little pecans green on it, you wouldn't really call it a peach tree, would you?
Okay, I feel you. Okay. So a good poet, you know, even if he's gifted, he's got to develop. He's got to grow.
Well, I think it's good anything grows. An athlete,
okay,
you know, when they first come in the league, they're called rookies.
Mm.
And you don't expect the same mistake from a rookie as you do a seasoned pro or somebody that's been to the Pro Bowl or somebody that's been to the NBA All-Star game or the baseball All-Star game or the hockey All-Star game because they've developed their skills.
Mm. Now, you do poetry slams all across the country. And you know, AJ's even a part of a poetry slam team. AJ, when you're getting ready to go up on stage, and I always wonder this when y'all do that, it's just like anybody with any other talent, if the person who goes before you just kills it, what does that do to your energy going up on stage?
Well, I think you gather energy from the audience. And
okay,
the person before you kills it, the audience is already high.
Okay.
So when you go out, you try and be at the level that person just left and take it higher.
Okay. But, you know, I mean, just like when comedians go out there, can't you go out there to a cold audience and you got to warm them up?
Oh, that happens all the time.
So what's your mindset when you go into the room and the people are not where you want them to be? What are you thinking?
Well, my thing is I don't think people can be where you want them to be when they haven't heard anything that you said yet.
Okay.
You have
okay.
to make them, you're like the bus driver. When they get on the bus, you take them to a tour, they don't know what they're going to see.
Wow.
But when you when you explain the houses, like, this house right here was Clark Gable's house, and after that it was some, and everybody's looking like, oh, I used to like Clark. Oh, I knew Groucho Marx. I knew this person. So now you're getting them interested in where you're going. So it's how you give the tour that makes the people want to ride with you again.
You know, hip-hop music has been described as, you know, as of late being dumbed down. You know, it's really just hot beats over a bubblegum lyrics. That said, is the same for poetry, or does the type of audience that appreciates poetry not need it to be dumbed down?
Well, I'm saying you have all types of audience, but as far as the hip-hop thing you just said, if you remember, it was, I think before Jay-Z's Black Album, he said he was dumbing down his lyrics.
Yeah.
Then everybody else began to dumb down their lyrics. Then Jay-Z came out with some tighter lyrics, like he just wanted to fool everybody else and then dumb down their lyrics so he could change the game. You know, at least that's where I perceived it.
That's what you think happened.
That's where I perceived it, you know.
I mean, because, you know, sometimes, you know, it's just like they say, having a conversation. If you have a conversation with somebody and you're talking over their head, you know, you're just really entertaining yourself. So when you're talking to your audience, is that taken into consideration when you're writing your pieces that, you know, oh, my God, that may be too in-depth, you know, they may not get that one, so therefore you reword it, or do you go with your first feeling for the piece?
I'm saying, as for me, I write a lot, you know, because I actually just finished a poem the other day, so I write a lot. So my thing is, when I go in, my father used to talk to me when I was small, but he'd tell me some things that he knew I wouldn't understand the whole of, but he knew I understood what he meant from where I was. But there were things I could mentally grow with, you know. So it wasn't that he gave me too much. He just gave me what I understood, but left something there I can grow with. So I think that's
okay.
What poets should do is give you something to take with you, not just something to eat there, something to take with you like a doggy bag or something.
So you want them thinking about you after you've gone and left the stage. On their way home, you want them to still be thinking about something you said on stage.
Exactly. You know, the best comedians, a lot of times when you get home, you laugh at the whole set. But there's a joke or two that you got on the way home.
Yeah.
And you just started laughing like, oh, okay, I got it.
Exactly.
You know, there's always something in there that you kind of keep with you because it should touch you in places that you hadn't expected to be touched that particular day.
Well, do you have favorite pieces that you do, or do you have favorite pieces where you think, okay, it killed in St. Louis, so I'm gonna have to try this in Chicago and Memphis too. Do you have those pieces where you just know they're gonna work?
Well, I used to, but I started thinking that every piece would work. And, you know, not being facetious or acting like I'm all this and that. It's just that, you know, me and a friend of mine, Dave Stunley, we did a 13,000-mile tour.
Mm-hmm.
We did 41 gigs. We went across the nation. And we went to places like Albuquerque, Salt Lake City, went to Vermont, went to Bellingham, Washington, and places in Washington I hadn't even heard of. And some of the places I went to, it looked like I was the only black in the city.
Whoa.
Not just an event. You know, riding around, I didn't see any of me. But the thing was, is the audience would gravitate to what's being said. They would gravitate to the message. So it didn't matter if I was talking about the black experience or if I was talking about love. It matters how you say it. And I guess my whole thing in it is it matters how you say it.
Well, AJ's going to have to give us a piece in a minute, y'all. AJ, you need to be thinking about that. If you just tuned in, you're listening to AJ Houston, the author of the new book titled Making It. He's also a very, very famous poet. And so, AJ, you know, I have a favorite piece, but, you know, every time you come on the show, I make you do that one. So we're not going to do that one tonight. Give us your favorite piece. Give us one that you know when you do it, you go, oh, I know this bad.
Let me see, because right now I'm learning 20 new pieces out of the book. So when I do book signings, I can just garner everything from the book. But I like everything in the book, so I guess my favorite piece would be the piece that I just memorized.
Okay. Okay, let's hear the piece you just memorized.
Okay, Tyler's piece is Collision. I don't use the precursion events, but when you're dealing with relationships, you know, there's a collision of sorts going on because, you know, you want to make sure that you're compatible, and sometimes who's going to be the boss, and if these two planets are colliding, what actions are they going to take, you know, and all these other things. So I was trying to envision this in my mind as I was writing the piece. So, you know, here's the piece of collision. No one man can, not even Atlas, could hold the Earth still. So when our worlds collided and you thought I wasn't trying to move them, I was. Just didn't have the power, wasn't made of the right substance. You see, I am formed of love. So you ask, what is love? Love is a cataclysmic eruption of emotions, eons of atoms and protons, battling to be bigger than a micron. This ball wasn't formed in a day. It took more than a millennia to get here. There's no such thing as 50-50. It's always been 100-100, and I am 250-plus. Love enough for the both of us, but again, you ask of love. Love is a young boy on a ladder, carving marks into the door jam, hoping to one day reach the height of his imagination. I've always believed that pain was an eclipse when smiles and frowns overlapped, making tears the only escape for our laughter, so I laugh a lot, said to be the best medicine. Love never came with forever attached. We pinned it on ourselves. It can only last as long as the life of the person who yields it, and it does. It never fails. Love is forever, lost in nowhere. With an X marking the spot, time is yet to pick up his shovel and dig up. We constantly grab at air for the substance we know will make us better stewards of hearts, but we're no surgeons. We use scaffolds to cut us apart. There are memories we've purposely forgotten, tucked away beneath the rubble of broken hearts we've survived. Faded footprints, muffled sounds of joy and sadness our shadows can no longer whisper. Love is a firm-footed juggler with bad hands. He couldn't hold in his palms if it was handed to him. We live in this bubble absorbing ultraviolet solar radiation, so when worlds collide, the atmospheric pressure renders humans unable to breathe, gravity fails us, volcanoes erupt, and we're jettisoned out of our comfort zone. Love is a 10-year-old girl afraid to double dutch because her family's allergic to ropes. An overweight personal trainer who knows perfectly well what to do but can't stick to the plan himself. Love is a song in A minor sung in E flat. A 109-yard touchdown return in a baseball game, spring in December, an anonymous note in the bottle with the signature on the bottom. Doesn't always fit in the box we hide it in. Love is cross stitches and patches on the knees of our jeans from begging heaven for the fireworks we believe contained in our childhood fantasies. If we should ever stop to notice, each day the sun rises. There's the brightest of glows with heat covering us all with solar flares. Combustible gas is exploding constantly. There are fireworks all around us. Maybe we were never told or could not detect for ourselves. Love is in the details. The instructions we never read, the blueprints we tossed to the side, thinking we can build it ourselves, but our fingers have never been long enough. Love is a merry-go-round on top of a Ferris wheel parents refuse to let their children play on. Love too often stands a quarter turn from an argument, a half step from a kiss, a waits eye from an apology, stands fistless in a bar fight. Love is a seesaw nailed to the edge of a cliff, window dressing stuffed in the belly of a turkey. Love kneels humbly in the presence of love, chest pumped in the face of regret, a firm handshake and compromise. It's the sprint after the marathon, a gold digger lost in a coal mine. Their actions bought a sound sealed in envelopes marked understand later. Even now they remain unopened. We possess the sharpest of minds, but our lazy tongue leaves us wanting. Love is a 10-question pop quiz no one knows the right answers to. A Ponzi scheme you've invested all your time and emotions in. A great story to tell, but you can't remember the ending. A hero saved by the damsel in distress. Love is a daughter trying hard to recall the last words her mother told her not to forget. Scoring a perfect 100 on a DNA test. Love is soldiers laughing on the final flight home. It's the first sigh in the morning, the last smile at night. Peace with a large helping of war on the side. A dentist performing brain surgery. Sea salt in the sugar dispensary. A mariachi band at a rap concert, its planets colliding. Egos and tongues fighting for superiority, each one to be the axis their world revolves around. An impact of magnanimous proportions. It's not yelling when you need to listen. It's waiting instead of acting. It's holding hands in the midst of the storm. You see, love is in the detail.
You memorized that. Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean,
how can you memorize 20 pieces, you know, that are that lengthy?
Well, because I wrote them.
Go ahead.
Now, when you think about it, you remember a whole lot of songs on the radio that you didn't have no part in writing.
That's true. You know, but I'm just amazed because, you know, one piece deals with so much subject matter. You know, so it sounds like you got to be well-read, you know, at least, to be able to, you know, write pieces like that. I don't know.
Well, I think the art of writing, it has to be the art of reading.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you don't know the writers before you and what they wrote, and, you know, because I always tell everybody, I say, there's no new words and very few ways to reorganize them and make them yours, so you have to do your best to draw the picture that you see with the words that you use.
You know, is a good piece of poetry much like a well-woven garment? Does every stitch have to be perfect before you say, okay, this is ready? Does it absolutely have to be perfect?
Well, kind of started with me. I really consider myself a concept writer. So, and sometimes I come up with the title, sometimes I come up with the piece. But I guess in high school, I emceed all the programs, I wrote poetry all the time. So, you know, my teacher used to always tell me every day that a poem should not say but be. And every day that had a different meaning, because to get on stage and say, I wrote this poem because of whatever, and if your poem doesn't say what you just said it was supposed to say, you need to go back and rewrite it.
So you know where you're going with it. So, you know, when you get to the end, if you did not make that point clear, you know you need to do some more writing.
You don't always know where you're going with it. You just know it has to go somewhere. So a lot of times you write it and take you to places you hadn't thought of going. But, it's like if you're going on, you know, if you go to Dallas and you're going to a place and you make a turn, you say, I didn't know this area was back here. Man, look at these houses. This is beautiful. And you might describe that a little bit before you go to the route that go to the place that you were initially going.
So writing poetry is like taking a journey.
It is taking a journey.
Okay. You know, the thing is, you know, most people, you know, who write a lot, you know, in terms of authors of books, they typically talk about something called writer's block. As a poet, do you ever experience that?
Well, I try and teach people how not to have writer's block. And see, I think writer's block comes when you, like the first question you ask me, you say, okay, do you write when you're inspired, or do you write when you're angry, or do you write when you're sad, or do you write when you're in love? I think you write it all those times. But you still write it all the times in between those times. But you have to teach yourself the art of motivating you. Because every day you get up, you're not motivated. I'm saying just like my Facebook post, it takes me like 5 minutes or so just to write whatever I put on Facebook. And when I get up in the morning, I don't have any idea what I'm going to put on Facebook. I sit there and say, okay, what? And I just start typing. And most of those things I have on Facebook aren't in any poems at all.
Listen, y'all, you call AJ's phone, you get a piece of poetry. I mean, seriously, everywhere AJ goes, he drops a piece of poetry, like on his Facebook page, like you said. Do you feel that those pieces inspire people? Do you get any feedback from the people that you know, read or hear those pieces?
Well, the reason I started posting a lot was because, you know, I would post and then probably 3 or 4 days and not post. My phone number is on Facebook. People would call me and text me and, you know, message me and say, hey, you haven't posted nothing in a couple of days, and I'm the only friend in the office that's a friend of yours on Facebook, and every day we sit down and pull up your page, and we might spend a day discussing that. And I was truly amazed that other people would share my posts and other people would read my posts, because, you know, a lot of times when you think you're doing something for you, you have to do it better when you know that other people are looking or listening.
Right. Do you feel any pressure, you know, when you wake up in the morning and not inspired to write anything, do you feel any pressure to give them something?
Well, I don't have those mornings.
Oh, wow. Yo, AJ and Kaki, he just being
I'm inspired to write some every day. I'm saying sometimes it may not be as, you know, because sometimes it may just be, because I think one day I was thinking of, after we had talked about Trayvon and all the other things, I wrote two lines. It says, letting others define what freedom means we would never be free.
Love that. You know, AJ, you know, in that whole thing, you know, we all have dark periods in our life, and I'm sure for Trayvon's family, this is a very dark period. But when you're going through dark periods in your life, does your poetry reflect the season that you're in?
Well, it does, but me, I really try. I'm an eternal optimist for truth. So even in the dark periods, I think there's a lesson in everything. So sometimes when we just focus on the dark, we don't see the light at the end of the tunnel or the light in the middle of the light we just passed. Or we don't see that we have a pocket full of light bulbs and we could have changed the darkness in the beginning.
Mm. You know, I mean, a lot of people feel like an artist's best work of lifetime, you know, is birthed out of pain. I mean, you'll hear artists say that, you know, I went through a really bad time, but, you know, that's some of my best work came out of that. Do you find some truth to that at all?
Well, that's, I'm saying it does, but that's what I'm saying. You can't write hurt and it just be hurt. You have to write hurt to show the experience in it, to show the lesson in it, to show, to me, I have to show that I learned something out of this day.
Mm. Mm. Now, AJ, you got some kids. When you chastise them or you know what you do. I don't have any kids, y'all, so I can just imagine how this goes with AJ. But AJ, when you're getting on them about something, do you find yourself rhyming your poetry, or does it become a
no. But that's what I'm saying. All my children know I'm just a happy-go-lucky person. I would tell them what to do, and I think I've taught them how to listen.
Ooh.
But I don't have a problem with beating that ass. But I don't yell and scream. I never yell and scream. I would talk to them like this, and if they don't do it, they get a whooping.
Oh, okay.
So,
but I just thought, you know,
there's no medium. There's no like, okay, he's going to say it four times, or he's going to yell and scream, he's going to say, I told you. No, I'm saying, I already told you, so I don't have to say I told you.
I just could imagine you know, beginning to, you know, try to get on him about something, and it just becomes a poetry situation. But it doesn't get serious, huh?
I've talked to him all his life, and, you know, I laugh and joke with him. I'm saying, because my thing is, I think in the morning, you know, because I tell him their job is school. So I tell him in the morning, I try and wake him up laughing and, you know, say, hey, you know, I already called the school. They're going to give a ticket tape parade when you get there. Everybody's going to be waiting for you, you know, have a good day and this kind of stuff. And they be laughing like, you know, my daddy crazy. But I want you to at least start your day off at this happy medium, because your day might not go good.
That's true.
But you didn't start at your day not going good.
Now, let me ask you this. You know, if someone, and I write a little poetry, y'all, but trust me, AJ makes me look like, you know, I'm still in kindergarten with mine. But anyway, that said, do you consider it a gift, or can poetry, the gift of, or the skill of poetry writing, can it be learned, or is it a God-given gift?
Well, I think it can be learned, but I think there's a creative side to all of us. And a lot of times, you know, maybe you didn't discover your creative side earlier, or maybe you were a dancer, or maybe you played an instrument. But a lot of people who play instruments start playing other instruments that they didn't initially play, and then they find that the music sounds like words, and they begin to write the lyrics.
Mm.
So that's what I'm saying. That's why I say there's a progression to the art.
Yeah, if you just tuned in, we're talking
about the person that's the artist.
Right. If you just tuned in, we're talking to AJ Houston, author of the new book, Making It. And AJ, you know, looking at this book, as a matter of fact, the cover is very beautiful. How did you come up with your cover? I mean, how do you decide? I haven't written a book yet. Yeah, I got one in me, but I haven't written it yet. How do you come up with, because AJ is very hands-on with his work. So how did you come up with your book cover, you know, you're just the whole book itself. How did you sit down and say, okay, this is how I'm going to put it together, you know, this is going to go here? Did you have any help outside of you, or did you just decide, this is my baby and I'm going to do it by myself?
Well, I actually sent it to two different proofreaders.
Mm.
And since it was so many pages, you know, I sent it to them like early December. So I was thinking that the book, you know, I'd have it back by end of February or March. You know, I wasn't trying to rush anybody. But then my birthday is in April, so when April came around, I'm calling people. They said, well, I'm almost done. I'm like, well, my birthday is in a couple of days. We, you know, I'm sending it off by my birthday. That was my goal. Although I sent it early enough for it to be off the beginning of the year. So, but the whole design and everything was my idea. And the picture on the cover, a friend of mine did a photo shoot. She did a photo shoot before. But we did a photo shoot downtown Fort Worth. And when I saw that picture, I was like, man, that picture's going to be awesome. I like that picture. And then she was laughing. So when I was going through, first I didn't have a picture on the cover. I was just making the cover. And then I saw that I was over this well with a penny. And I was thinking that making it isn't a wishful thing. It's an action. So as long as I hold the penny, I hadn't dropped a wish. I hadn't made a wish. That's the movement. So to me, making it was this action. So I'm holding this penny over this whistling wheel just in case my actions don't work. I'm gonna drop this penny.
And you just happen to be over a wishing well.
Yeah, I'm saying, and that's where I got the idea from the picture as I was working on the cover.
So, AJ, you know, 80 pictures.
Yeah,
and that's the way, it is a beautiful cover.
I had a whole photo shoot downtown.
Wow. So, you know, they say, how does the scripture go that a prophet isn't honored in his own, amongst his own kin or something like that? Y'all know which scripture I'm talking about if you're Bible reading people. But you know which one I'm speaking of, AJ. That said, do your family and your friends appreciate your gifts, or do they get it? Or, you know, sometimes we're just not.
I think your family and friends were put there to keep you humble.
Ooh.
Because they know what you've been doing all this time, so it's not new to them, and they really probably don't see the growth in your art or in what you do. They just say, he's always right. So for you to think that you're this best whatever, or this good whatever, and they just treat you like you're nothing, you have to have that happy balance between, because you know most of the time your family and friends are gonna be one thing. Oh yeah, you know the book's all right. Yeah, it look all right, man. I'm gonna get around to reading it. And, you know, you're jumping around and skipping and with a pom-pom and Shirley's and, you know, confetti flying around. You think you did this great job. And they just saying, yeah, well, you know, it took you long enough to come up with a book. Yeah, okay. We're going to get to it.
Okay. You don't want to feel it.
It's humble.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because you know what, it's amazing. You can be as gifted as you want to be and be around your family, and they'd be like, I knew you when. You know, so it's just, you can't get too big for family and friends. So I was just wondering if you'd experience that. But, AJ, is that true, though, that poetry has a newfound popularity? Why now? What is that all about?
Well, I think what happened is that people discovered that a lot of people didn't know themselves. And in school, a lot of children were having a problem with, you know, with speaking, because, you know, it is last 4 or 5 years, the hardest job in the world was, you know, I guess, public speaking.
Mm.
At least it was this job in the world. So you have all these people that are afraid to speak publicly. So what poetry did is it gave everybody an arena where they can get up there and say something that they wanted to say. Or be themselves, or recite somebody else's work and be somebody else for a minute, but it's just being in public. So being on stage and in public gives you a certain courage about yourself that you have the ability to do something. So poetry took off when everybody started to come like, hey, man, so I'm saying, we had to Roddy writers before with a long time ago, like 99, 2000. We were performing everywhere. But people used to ask, "What do you do?" I'm a poet. Oh, yeah, you're a poet. Okay, sit in their poem. You know, it's like, okay, I can, but it wasn't like they were ready. It's like, okay, if you're a poet, you know, exciting. Give me something about, you know, to keep some weird topics. But see, what I did is I've been writing all my life, so in the army, my friends have something to say.
Okay, you're fading out on this?
Okay, now I'm in the army. My friends would come to me and say, okay, if you're a poet, write me
you're fading
out
again.
Okay, you hear me now?
That's better. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now in the army, my friends would come to me and say, okay, you're a poet, write me a poem about whatever. So I would accept the challenge and write them a poem about whatever they requested. So I think that was my teaching element in teaching me to write regardless.
You know, AJ has had a sense of humor, y'all, since he was in the military. And I think he would say poetry even to the people that were under him in the military. AJ, what's the saying that you used to tell them when you tell them to do something and they question whether or not that was the right thing to do? You would say what?
If I tell your mouth can pull a house, hook him up, we're moving.
You know, so, AJ, anyway, I used to, I don't know, AJ, anyway, I'm going to leave that alone, but yeah, that AJ has had a sense of humor and a gift for rhyming for a long time. AJ, when you're writing, does the environment have to be quiet or can you write even in the middle of chaos? Does it have to be still and quiet?
I might write better in the midst of chaos, because in an enclosed area, I can write. But it's like an open space, my mind expands and I can find more substance.
Mm.
But I've written, you know, in
in all arenas with music playing, in venues where we're performing with the band playing. I've written, you know, so I've written in probably, you know, every type of arena. And I may have finished it, you know.
Go ahead.
Not that I may have finished it when I got home, but the thing is once you write it down, see, when an idea comes to you, just like I'm quite sure some nights you say, oh, yeah, I'm going to do a show about this, and I'm going to entitle this, and you're gonna work on it. And then you say, okay, I'll write it when I get up. And when you get up in the morning, you say, oh, now what was that show I said I was going to do, and what was the title of that show I said I was going to do? You remember in essence what it was, but it was just the way you had it worded, the way you put the words together made it perfect. But now you can't find it.
So speaking of that, in the middle of the night, are you inspired, you know, by a particular thought? And when you are, do you jump up immediately and write it down, or how do you handle that?
Well, I actually believe inspiration is a person. Mm. It just wakes you up in the middle of the night and gives you something and just stand back and see what you're going to do with it. A lot of times I get up and write it down.
So you get up then.
It won't be the same when I wake up in the morning. Yeah, it won't be the same when I wake up in the morning.
Okay. So you stop what you're doing and get, or you wake up from your sleep and get up and write it down.
Carrie, believe it or not, I always have like 4 ink pens in my pocket.
No.
I have pens inside my bed. You know, because I say sometimes your favorite pen won't write.
Hmm.
You know, so you know, instead of asking somebody, hey, can I borrow your pen? Now I have another pen. I'm gonna find something to write with, because I'm saying it's really that way. Because I think I can. Sometimes I work on like 4 or 5 pieces at once. And
now I would find that confusing. How is that possible that you can work on 4 or 5 at the same time? Because I'm sure they all have different subject matter. So how can you do that?
Well, Tara, I think if we use 10% of our brain, and there's 90% of our brain we don't know nothing about, there's a whole lot of things we can do that we don't know.
That's true. That's true.
So, I think my brain has these allocated spots to where I'm working on one piece and a line will come to me like, oh, that goes to the other piece. I can go right to the other piece and write that line.
Mm.
And I don't know why. I don't know why it just works that way sometimes.
Well, since we're speaking of your pieces, can you give us something else, AJ?
Let me see. Yeah, I actually want to read some out of the book because I actually wrote this piece that, you know, Juneteenth is coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what Juneteenth is, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. Explain to everybody what Juneteenth is.
No, I want you. Well, you know what? Well, I'll tell them. Yeah, I don't celebrate the holiday personally, and I don't celebrate the holiday because, you know, it almost. And I hope no black person is offended, but this is just me, a black person, being very honest. I could not understand how slavery could be over, and people and slaves in 2 states not know that slavery had ended. And so for several years after that, they still remained slaves. So therefore, the date in which they found out they were free is when we celebrate Juneteenth. So, you know, I personally, for that reason, I just can't understand the story, you know, behind Juneteenth, because it defies logic. Because this is the way I think of that, and I'm just going to say this, put this out there. Oklahoma borders Texas. Arkansas borders Texas. So in my estimation, I'm thinking at any point, one of the slaves could have just crossed the street and seen that the rest of the slaves that used to be slaves aren't slaves anymore. So why is it that they never got that for several years? So that was my problem with that, AJ.
But Carrie, imagine this. Imagine that you were taken from your homeland, put in the belly of a ship in 36 inches, and brought to a country you didn't know anything about, taken to a place you didn't even know where it was, and you're working on this property that has this big fence around it. So when they say you're free, where are you going?
That's true. Yep.
You don't know any place. You don't have any money. You know, so, and me, I understand what happened, but I'm not understanding the celebration.
Okay.
I understand it has to be noted that, see, we mark days in history, so we hope in hopes it won't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But,
so your piece is about Juneteenth?
No, the title of the piece is Deception.
Okay.
See, there are defects in the soles of my shoes.
These must be the ones Martin and Malcolm wore. They were placed in the halls of Nevermore after we thought we'd won us some free. The right to vote, right of choice, right to assemble, and many more walls of rights are being torn down. These shoes had to be newly fitted. A monster still resides in the closet of the house we no longer own. Snakes have infested the lawns of yesterday. Monuments must be removed to begin again. We've been deceived, ran afoul, pulled the wool over. My mother warned me about regressing, using anger as the voice of reason. This road has been washed, bones scrubbed to remove memory, family tree turned to mulch on purpose. I returned the letter to the 1%, a heavy surcharge for remembering. Delivered a tombstone of remorse, flowers cannot grow there. Refusing to desecrate, holy shallow unmarked graves. The bridge is on in London, but they've all fallen down. Destroyed the ghetto for a high rise. Railroad tracks takes us back to old neighborhoods, to a place of unity. A word we define, built on the backs of Negroes, now the sons of black men, are relegated to picking cotton or selling drugs. There's no detectable difference. I am my grandfather's son's son, who once again must tread lightly through the halls of an education system where cracks are the size of canyons our history fell through. Its library is a misbegotten haven for unjust truth. We've been fed since childhood. It storms while the sun is shining. There's blood in the laces, skin in the seams. I was told to wear them as they are. I can still smell Selma and New York. Gunpowder stains are not removable. The struggle preserved the aroma of water hoses, police dogs, nightsticks. They say prejudice doesn't live here anymore. And hate is a word we fabricated the existence of. These shoes march when I want to run. We are the blunt force trauma trapped in the jokes they keep telling. Camouflaged in the words of taking America back, although it's never ventured far from the plantations of its birth. There are lies stamped in the seal of its birth certificate, in the ink and signatures at the bottom of the Constitution, hiding in the preamble, whipped into the backs of slaves owned by presidents. His story celebrates his heroes. We haven't a clue who arrived here first. How can we get to any tomorrow gurgling the truth off our tongues of yesterday? We have bonfire branches with ropes attached, viewing the picnic from glowing embers. We have scarred knees removing spills from hardwood floors. We are college-educated men who flunked a class in fatherhood. We are dead men walking. Everywhere there are mountains needs to be climbed and still no mountaintops in sight. We are the last sound in the echo, so easily forgotten. There's blood in the laces, skin in the seams, oceans of tears on the soles of these shoes. But I will do as I'm told and wear them as they are.
I like that. So, you know, so that piece was inspired by Juneteenth.
No, well, it was inspired by the deception that America keeps giving us.
Okay.
And Juneteenth is just one of those moments.
Okay. Because, you know, the thing is, I wonder, you know, and I know black folks, you know, where we live, AJ, they just, this is a big celebration time here in this area. But I just, you know, for years I'd never even heard of the holiday from where I came from. And so when I got to this area and it was, you know, a major holiday for African Americans, I just found it like, wow, like how could that be? I mean, it had escaped my history all those years. I was in adulthood when I first heard of the Juneteenth celebration, and it just, I was just blown away, like, how can that be? And so, you know, that's just what that is, y'all, and I hope no one is offended by that, but it's just, I'm just being very truthful, and I'm being transparent tonight, and that's just how I felt. But AJ, let me ask you this. So, you know, you as a poet, are there other, you know, poets that you admire or look up to?
Oh, there's a lot of poetry. See, my mind is different, because I remember most of the poets' pieces that I like, that has some substance in it. Like there's a friend of mine in town, her name is Janine Livingston. She's probably the coldest poet I know. And she actually won the individual championships, the co-champion of the Indy World Championships of slam poetry. But they didn't really acknowledge her, so it was like, to her it was a slight, so it was hard for her to get past that. But she is a great poet, and there's other poets in the Metroplex. There's poets from all over the nation, and a friend of mine, Shane Corzan, he actually wrote a poem that he did last year in the Winter Olympics. He opened up in Canada when he came out of the top of the little thing, top of the parade, and did a poem for Canada. at the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics. And you see poetry gravitating to these levels that nobody thought it would be.
Mm.
But the poets that are writing have such substance warranting that type of media attention.
Wow. So, and you know, poetry is and I've heard some great pieces, y'all. AJ's included in that group. That said, when you listen to some of the music out here today, does it ever make you wonder, like, why didn't they get somebody to write something for them? I mean, what, you know, why are they writing about that? And we talked earlier about it being dumbed down. But don't you listen to some of the lyrics today and you see no craft in the way the songs are put together at all? Just no depth, no.
I hate to say this, but I'm in agreement with you. Because a lot of times you hear the hook, and the hook is basically the whole song.
The whole song.
The whole song with the bass beats. And then a lot of the rappers, they make up words in the process just so it'll rhyme with whatever they said last.
Mm-hmm.
And it's overlooked by the people, you know, jamming to it. They say, oh, he made this word up. That's not a word.
It's amazing what people will accept. I mean, it just, I don't know. We've lowered our standards so much that, you know, they can just really pretty much with music throw anything out there. And then you listen to a great poet and you're thinking, that needs to be a song. You know, there's so much depth to it. And you just rarely see that in music at all. I mean, you just don't. You know, but, you know, it is what it is. But, AJ, isn't it true that colleges are offering creative writing as a degree plan now?
Yes, they do. And not only that, they have an MFA that's a master's, but it's basically for creative writing.
Whoa, a master's?
It's an MFA. It's called MFA. And
okay.
A lot of people are actually, you know, taking that, getting a degree, and basically getting a degree in creative writing.
Hmm.
And that's why I say poetry has reached this level, because I think now it's understood that being able to teach somebody to write is being able to give them an outlet for their emotions, because a lot of people wouldn't have to go to therapy if they kept a journal.
So you feel like when you're in a heart period or trying period that your writing is therapeutic to you?
I'm saying writing saved my life.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Because the thing is, okay, like, just a little bit of my head. I worked for Vought Aircraft for almost 20 years, making grand theft money.
Mm.
Then I was injured on the job, had 5 back surgeries. But each time I was at Vought, I created a gospel choir, I directed the choir. Every program they had, they wanted me to write a poem for the program. So I was this hourly worker hanging out with the VP of Human Resources, because every time she had something going on, she wanted my creative input. And everybody else was angry because this elderly white lady would always come down and get me to go somewhere else when they say, you know, you're supposed to be building airplanes. I'm like, well, talk to her. I didn't come and get me, you know. And they didn't like that. But the thing is there's always a space for you even though you don't know it's your space.
Mm. Always. Mm. I can hear that. Well, let me ask you. Have you ever written pieces where when you finish, you said, damn, that was good? I mean, have you ever wondered, like, where did that come from? I mean, it exceeded your own expectations.
Well, you know, I tell you, I wrote a poem a day for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't go over some of those pieces until I was actually typing them up.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, I don't remember writing this, because when your mind is in that moving mode, you don't really have time to look back and see what it was you did yesterday.
Mm.
And I think that actually taught me a lot, because it was, you know, what I did is when I was working on I have a calendar with 365 original quotes. And when I thought of doing it, I thought it would take me a long time to do it. So I made this agreement with me that when I finished it, I was going to write a poem every day. And I started the calendar like in November. By the middle of December, I finished the calendar. So then that left me January 1st. I had to start keeping my obligation to me as far as writing a poem every day. So that's why I wrote 365 poems, because this agreement I made with myself, because I really believe that if you can't keep a word to you, you can't really talk to anybody else.
Yeah, know that's AJ Houston. And yeah, and I agree for the most part. So you took it that you still, even though you completed it, you needed to go still every day and write additional pieces.
Well, that's what I told myself I would do. Because in the calendar I got to June, you know, I thought I was moving, I was writing all these quotes and it was moving good. I'm fine, you know, every day I'm sitting there, I come up with another, I'm typing it down, and I think that I'm making a lot of ground. And I looked up and I was just in June. And then when I started thinking about what June was in the calendar, I'm like, that's just halfway there. And first it was disheartening because I was, you know how you kind of talk to yourself like, well, you know, I didn't really tell a whole lot of people I was going to do this calendar, so I can put it off and, you know, just work on it slowly and try and get it done. But the resolve was me. I kept saying, no, I told me I was going to do it.
Hmm.
So it didn't matter who else I told I was going to do it. So that was, I guess, that was the force that made me finish the calendar. It's because it was a challenge to me from it. Say what?
What advice would you give to up-and-coming poets?
Well, what I would tell them is to read other people's work, but don't borrow too much.
Wow.
Because, see, I tell you, I remember everybody's poem. I have a friend, his name is Sekou the Misfit out of L.A. Right now, he's actually, he has about 35 corporate sponsors, Oprah, Nike, Deepak Chopra. I'm saying he got giant sponsors. He does corporate events. And he's getting ready to do LeBron's Life in a Poem for Nike. So he's making grand theft money, real money. And I'm saying, one of the favorite lines he has in one of my favorite lines he has in one of his poems, he says, I give spare change to the beggars on the street on the condition that if I'm standing here begging tomorrow, you better hit me back.
Ooh. I like that. And so he's doing major events. So there's a potential to make major money in poetry today, where maybe 5 years ago that wasn't the case.
Oh, definitely. I'm saying I think it started probably in 06. 06 for not the national championship game in college football, but the game before the national championship game. They had a poet open up the game doing a poem with football and stuff in the background. So it was like the first introduction besides HBO Death Poetry and Lyric Cafe and all these other events that had poetry. This was poetry tied into the mainstream.
Mm.
And then another friend of mine, Shehan out of Cali. Shehan did a Nike commercial. No, not Nike, he did a Reebok. I think he did a Reebok commercial with poetry.
So as a person who, you know, is pursuing poetry as a career, do you have to pursue them, or does your craft eventually make them find you?
Well, I think, it happens in different ways. A lot of times you might know somebody that knows somebody. And when they see your work, they're going to say, man, I didn't know you said they did poetry. I thought you said, man, they doing poetry, you know. But other times it's like putting out a book like this one. I hope that's why the book is like 251 pages from cover to cover. Well, it's 260 pages from cover to cover. But I wanted to include more material than the average book I see, because it's hard to garner the perception or the concept of a writer when there's just a couple of pieces.
Now, how many pieces of poetry is in this book?
I don't know. It's actually 254 pages.
Wow.
And
okay.
And in the book there is, I call it life, love, poetry, and everything else, because like my mother, when I learned to read by her reading to me books of Dr. Seuss. So I have a prose piece in the book called My Mother and the Professor, which is me paying homage to her for teaching me the difference between a doctor and a professor, because, you know, a lot of preachers in the pulpit have doctor behind their name. And when you go to the doctor to get your shots, that's a doctor. But all these people, so Dr. Seuss, you didn't know if he was a doctor that was going to give you shots or a preacher behind the pulpit, but it was all these things, and Dr. Seuss created such characters from nothing.
Wow.
So, you know, you ask anybody the cat in the hat, you automatically see the hat. You see the big hat with the stripes on it, real tall. And that's, he created that. So me growing up seeing somebody create everything from nothing means that words have such power that you have to kind of wrangle them or ride them to make them be what you want them to be, in order to be anything with words.
Mm. Wow. Before we close out tonight, can you give us one more piece from the book? And we're going to ask for no more, y'all. We're just going to have to give us three. And we ain't going to ask for no more, we promise. Give us one piece.
Okay, I have a daughter that was a captain in the military in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They just retired her a couple of months ago, and she's not mm-hmm. that old, but she has PTSD. So
ooh.
To me, they were actually retiring her because it was like the Army tries, they're not relinquishing their duties of you, but they're, to be retired, it's like, okay, we have all these other facilities that can take care of you. And my son, he just got back from Afghanistan in March of this year, his second tour. So, and you know, I was in the Army, so I wrote this poem basically about this string of, I guess, family relations and trying to get other people to understand. The title of the poem is Paid in Full. I'm not for sure how many pair I've owned, but the last pair, I must have walked the spit shine off. Somewhere between Stuttgart, Germany, repairing helicopters in the deep woods of Arkansas. A dusty, worn, Eureka pair of boots resting in the bottom of my duffel bag. Name and serum number barely visible, but would gladly trade them in, lace tight on my feet if I could be the replacement for my sons or daughters' next tour in Iraq or Afghanistan. Not all of this free America agrees on the price we paid for freedom. The one thing we can agree on is that freedom ain't never been free. I love the way in spotlights and on stages, your tongue dangles like a rope on the branch of an oak after a hanging, so loose and so free. Spit those words, but no, for history's sake, millions traded limbs, nightmares, and breath, so you can stand there, rant, rave, filibuster, and scream those words you sound so sure of people you've never really met, events you've never witnessed. It just sounds good to say. I adore how freedom sounds so clear, racing through speakers, bouncing off walls and open mics. My daughter has PTSD, but you can never feel it in her hugs. And my son arrived from Afghanistan healthy in one piece, unlike some parents I know who proudly display a medal of honor and a folded flag in lieu of smiles. So those things you think are so important doesn't hold the weight of an empty body bag. I love the way your political parties and your team pieces look. When you interlock your arms, feet rhythmically moving and talk about this disgusting dirt on any free town in these United States. I'm sorry your political parties and your portrait venues are feuding. It just doesn't sound like war to me. But you will never see the big picture if I curl it in 4D. But there are troops like sentinels watching over you while you sleep so you can wake and be angry at someone else for nothing. I love the way your mouth opens and your hold of words glide from side to side so fluidly, making me feel like you paid for some free or have a freedom card in your wallet for credit on the free you've yet to use. I told my son to watch his back when he arrived overseas. Should have told him the streets in this America are much more dangerous because too many people think they pay for freedom themselves. No matter how many pages we write as a collective, there's still more blood than ink seeping into soil on foreign lands from soldiers and those fighting with them. Now tell me again how you hate this Congress, this government, this president. It has to feel good to get it off your chest. I love the way your tongue unties like nooses. Wish your words didn't sound like ropes with skin still present. I bet your ancestors, I bet your forefathers, I bet your ancestors would be proud of the gold, platinum, diamond, encrusted freedom chain around your neck, your ankle. Let me see your expensive freedom watch one more time. How many tongues, how many lives did it cost? We can never use a moment of silence as paying homage for one life lost. If we use the quietest payment, we would cease to speak. Reversing time is just a simple wish for suckers, afraid to take one step into the now and be real with. So I dusted off my size 11 to show that I'm ready. Completely aware all the freedoms we use so freely ain't never been free.
Ooh, I love that. I love that. So how, that piece seems like it has a lot of emotion attached to it. So were you a little angry when you wrote it or a little disappointed with how things went down
I think it was all encompassing because I was looking at having the first black president and having the full Republican Party sign a blacklist, agreeing to not do anything to help him help Americans. And it wasn't that they didn't want Americans to get help. It was that they didn't want to be in agreement with this black man.
Mm.
And I had that problem. And then seeing that George Bush started the wars and that we had all these soldiers over here dying, and there was no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and Bin Laden was supposed to be in Afghanistan or wherever he was, but all these things were going on, and we losing all these soldiers and all these children, and then the people weren't being taken care of when they got back. You know, it was all these things all rolled up in one that it just reminded me of the time of, like, right after slavery, when there was nothing that could be done to the people that were supposed to be recently freed. And it's not just us, because the women were still fighting for the right to vote, and they didn't want women to vote after they got the right to vote.
Right.
So there's always been this step and stage of getting what you were supposed to get from whatever constitutional amendment or whatever was written in these papers that you didn't get, because when it said all men are created free, there was still this three-fifths amendment that we were still three-fifths of a human being. And then the voting rights still need to be ratified every, 15, 20 years, whatever?
Something like that.
So we as blacks in America, we can vote, but they still have to ratify voting rights. It's not law.
That is very true. That is very true. AJ, last question. How do you come up with the titles to these pieces?
Well, it's an interesting concept, because when I see what the piece is about, because sometimes I might come up with a title, write the piece, and change the title. Sometimes I might come up with a piece and then think about it and write the title. But I guess from my high school teacher, I told you earlier, she said a poem should not say but be. So I guess my whole thought process is that the only thing I want you to get from the poem that I wrote is what the title said you should get.
Okay. Well, AJ Houston, tell them how to get to your website and how to buy your book.
Well, actually, I have a book release page on Facebook, and it's book release for making it. You can, and my name is AJ Houston. My email is ajwordartist@gmail.com, so you can find me. I'm actually hosting an event down in Cobb Park in Fort Worth tomorrow, a Juneteenth festival. And I think I'm performing at the Soul Fest tomorrow night in DeSoto. And there's a slam every Tuesday night at Barcelona's at 511 Houston. That's on the corner of 5th and Houston. There's a Natty Roots every second and fourth Wednesday. It's on the corner of Cooper. Yes.
You didn't tell them what city that was.
Oh, downtown Fort Worth. It's
okay.
On
the
corner of Houston and 5th Street.
Yeah.
511 Houston. And then in Arlington, Texas, there's Natty Roots every second and fourth Wednesday, a great event. In Dallas, there's Heroes. There's a slam and open mic every Friday night. And there's other events going on. But you can actually find me on my Facebook. I have a Twitter. My Twitter is AJ Word Artist, because they closed my AJ Houston one. Yeah. That's a long story. But it's AJ Word Artist on Twitter. And AJ Houston on Facebook, and AJ Word Artist on YouTube. So you can find me on all the mediums, but I say hit me up. And my number, I don't care about getting my number is 817-797-8813. I perform, you can book me, you can hit me on my email, ajwordartist@gmail.com for booking, or you can call me 817-797-8813 for booking, or you can hit me on my Facebook.
Hey, y'all. And listen, if anybody's interested, if y'all didn't get that information, I will have it available. You can just send us an email, and we'll get it to you as well. But AJ is bookable, y'all, so hit him up on his Facebook, on his Twitter, or contact him via phone like he gave you. Okay, y'all, that's going to have to be the final word. I had a great time tonight. Listen, we talked about who is the real George. And our second hour, we talked to AJ Houston about his new book, Making It. So, listen, y'all, this is what we do each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. It goes down right here on this same bat channel, same bat time, every week. If you like what we do here on Center Stage and like to advertise with us, send us an email at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. centerstageradio@yahoo.com, and we'd love to talk to you about that. Also, again, I'd like to say thank you tonight, Travis Schaefer, Alberta Parrish, and AJ Houston for being with me tonight. Okay, we got to get out of here and make way for somebody else that does what we do. But again, join me here next Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. Here on Center Stage, our motto is less music, more talk. See you next week. Bye-bye.